Good morning. I was thinking I was going to add a new song next week, and now I for sure am. The song is called Run and Run. The first verse goes, based on what you were talking about, JT, it's very fitting, but the first verse goes, run and run, the law demands, but gives me neither feet nor hands. It gives you what to do and not the ability to do it, but better news the gospel brings. It bids me fly and gives me wings. So I was thinking we might do that song soon, and now I'm for sure. that's what we're all about here at Freshwater is gospel. You should hear gospel every week. If not, something is wrong. Please come and find us and tell us. But I am TJ. I am one of the elders now at Freshwater Church. Thank you. Please open your Bible to 1 Samuel chapter 8. We are resuming our series in 1 Samuel that we are calling Rejected, Revealed, Restored. And this name came in large part from the passage that JT preached from a couple weeks ago, and today we'll actually be focusing on chapters 9 and 10. That's two whole chapters, I know. I'm going to be going pretty quick this morning, and we will be reading a lot, so please bear with me. But I asked you to turn to chapter 8 for a quick review. 1 Samuel chapter 8. A couple weeks ago, we looked at this passage and saw how Israel demanded a king to rule over them. And in and of itself, this seems innocent enough, but we saw pretty clearly that it was not innocent at all. In fact, it was downright hostile. This is 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 6 through 9. And since we're going to be reading a lot, and I'm going to be kind of interjecting with talking, I'm going to be reading it from this. Please know it's all from here. Anytime I'm quoting the Bible, it is from the Bible, but I'm going to be reading it from a piece of paper, so bear with me on that, too. It's just so I don't get lost. But this is 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 6 through 9. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds that they have done, from the day I brought them up out of Egypt even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them." Then Samuel does as God tells them and warns them of all the dangers that come with trading the kingship of God for a human king. But the people respond like this in verse 19 of that same chapter. But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, "No, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." Israel emphatically rejects God and his warnings. God very plainly tells Samuel the truth of the matter. They have rejected God and his kingship. They did not trust God to be their political or military leader. They thought, hey, we can do this better ourselves. And the rest of the Samuels, and really the rest of the Bible, is a display of God's mercy and grace and power as he reveals his covenant faithfulness and authority and restores his people to be a kingdom under God's rule once more. But today, we're going to be looking at chapters 9 and 10 to see the first step of this process of God's plan to reveal his power and restore his rule. These two chapters are largely what I like to call stacking the odds. Throughout the Bible, we see God working in a variety of ways, but one of his most consistent strategies, one of the most consistent strategies God seems to use to make his glory known and to prove his might is to give himself or his prophets or his people an insanely large disadvantage. Then, once it seems like there's no way that God can get them out of the mess that they're in, he blows his enemies out of the water as if it was nothing. Essentially, God is always proving that he can overcome literally any obstacle in literally any scenario. And some examples that come to mind includes God's victory over the prophets of Baal in 1 Kings chapter 18, The prophet Elijah moves against the prophets of Baal, saying that Yahweh is the true God, and he can prove it. If they both set up altars to the respective gods and pray that their god sets the altar aflame, the altar that catches flame first will be the altar of the true God. And the prophets of Baal agree to these terms, and they begin to sacrifice to God, to Baal, and pray to him. But God's prophet, Elijah, takes it a step further. Elijah seemed to think, for whatever reason, that the altar to Yahweh was simply too dry. He had the people take jars of water and saturate the altar and the sacrifice and the ground with this water. And once the area was wet enough to make it impossible for a human being to light it, then God set a flame down to the altar that was so hot it evaporated all of the water around it. I'm also reminded of Gideon in Judges chapter 7. Israel had been pinned down by the Midianites, and God had raised up Gideon to lead his people in battle against them. And Gideon had 32,000 men at his disposal. But God says this in Judges 7:2, if we can get that up there. The people with you, yes, are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me. And God tells Gideon to send all the men that were scared back home. And that's 22,000 of the 32,000 men went home, and 10,000 stayed behind. And then God said, still too many. And God told Gideon to tell them to drink some water, and the ones who drank with their heads down, send them home too. And so Gideon was left with 300 men out of the original 32,000. That's less than 1%. But God gave Gideon a plan involving torches and jars and trumpets. Read the story sometime. It's great. But the main point is this. Judges 7:22, I think we also have that one. Judges 7:22 says, when they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the army, and the army fled. God did that. Gideon's army didn't even have to strike anyone. The Lord set their own swords against their own army. Never tell him the odds. But in regards to today's text, here's what I want us to see as we read through 1 Samuel chapters 9 and 10. This is a juxtaposition of the kingship that God has to offer against the kingship that humanity has to offer. Remember, God was supposed to be their political leader. God was supposed to be their military leader, but they wanted a human to perform in those roles instead. And God is going to stack the odds in humanity's favor in this situation, but God will still come out victorious as the true and better king. And note this, the one that's stacking the odds is God himself. This is God doing this. And this portion of text is largely a setup for the rest of the book, but that doesn't mean that there aren't things here that we can glean from it today. There are really three main points that I want us to notice as we read through these two chapters. Point number one, God is in control. There is nothing in today's text that takes God by surprise or gives him concern that something's going to go awry. He is sovereign over all. He is king over everything. Point number two, there are two sides in the war between God and sin. Humanity historically takes the wrong side. We take the side of sin. And point number three, you can usually tell which side is which by the apparent advantage. God tends to stack the odds against himself. Nevertheless, he still always ends up victorious. So let's read 1 Samuel chapters 9 and 10 and look at how God sovereignly stacks the odds in favor of humanity and against himself. This is 1 Samuel starting in chapter 9, verse 1. Now the donkeys of Kish, too late there. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Bechorath, son of Aphiah, a Benjaminite, a man of wealth. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. So we have a young man who is tall, dark, handsome, and rich. Let's continue. Well, first of all, let's point this out, the elephant in the room. JT is also very tall. Being tall is not bad. It's okay. We can forgive him for being tall. But in this day, it was very important. It was seen as a huge advantage because fighting in wars was a very physical thing. Being tall had its advantages, for sure. Continuing. Now, the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. So Kish said to Saul, his son, "Take one of the young men with you, and arise, go, and look for the donkeys." And he passed through the hill country of Ephraim, and passed through the land of Shalishah. But they did not find them. And they passed through the land of Shalim, but they were not there. Then they passed through the land of Benjamin, but he did not find them. When they came to the land of Zoph, Saul said to his servant who was with him, "Come, let us go back, lest my father cease to care about the donkeys and become anxious about us." But he said to him, "Behold, there is a man of God in this city, and he is a man who is held in honor. All that he says comes true. So now let us go there. Perhaps he can tell us the way we should go." Then Saul said to his servant, "But if we go, what can we bring the man? For the bread in our sacks is gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?" The servant answered Saul again, "Here, I have with me a quarter of a shekel of silver, and I will give it to the man of God to tell us our way. Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he said, 'Come, let us go to the seer.' For today's prophet was formerly called a seer." And Saul said to his servant, "Well said, come, let us go." So they went to the city where the man of God was. As they went up the hill to the city, they met young women coming out to draw water and said to them, "Is the seer here?" They answered, "He is. Behold, he is just ahead of you. Hurry. He has come just now to the city because the people have a sacrifice today on the high place. As soon as you enter the city, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat till he comes. Since he must bless the sacrifice afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now go up, for you will meet him immediately." So they went up to the city. As they were entering the city, they saw Samuel coming out toward them on his way up to the high place. Now, pay close attention to these next words here, verses 15 through 17. Now, the day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed to Samuel, "Tomorrow about this time, I will send to you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people Israel. He shall save my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have seen my people because their cry has come to me." When Samuel saw Saul, the Lord told him, "Here is the man of whom I spoke to you. He it is who shall restrain my people." That word "restrain" here can also be translated to rule over. So what we have here is not just a neat coincidence, right? Everything we've read so far is God's sovereignty in action. Check this out, verse 15. The day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed to Samuel, "Tomorrow about this time, I will send to you a man from the land of Benjamin." Saul saw these events up to this point as a really inconvenient weekend, right? He's got to find these donkeys. And even those of us reading this today might be seeing a story about a man who lost his donkeys, but God doesn't describe it that way to Samuel. God tells Samuel that he's sending him a man from Benjamin. And he tells him that the day before, lest we think that God is taking credit for something that happened outside of his influence. God is stacking the odds even now. He sent Samuel, a tall, handsome, rich young man named Saul, to anoint as king over Israel. This is the representative of humanity. He's everything people value in one package. And the crazy part here is that Saul tried not to go to Samuel, right? Now, I don't think that's because Saul knew what was going to happen. His objection to seeing Samuel was actually kind of legitimate. He said, "We don't have anything to give him." And that's almost noble of him to suggest, but as if compelled by God himself to do so, his servant happened to be carrying enough to constitute about a day's wage. Convenient. Now they can go to the prophet. At least that seemed good enough for Saul. Now the ideal man is approaching God's prophet because he happened to lose his donkeys, happened to be searching for them near Samuel, his servant happened to remember that Samuel was there, and he happened to be carrying an offering to give to the prophet in exchange for information about these donkeys. Perhaps. Or more assuredly, because God had a plan and he was going to enact it. He's sovereign over everything. Whether Israel likes it or not, God is king. But God's not done. I like to think that these odds are still too favorable for God's taste. He's only got one hand tied behind his back at this point. It's too easy. So let's continue in chapter 9, verse 18. Then Saul approached Samuel in the gate and said, "Tell me, where is this house of the seer?" Samuel answered Saul, "I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for today you shall eat with me. And in the morning I will let you go and will tell you all that is on your mind. As for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all your father's house?" Saul answered, "Am I not a Benjaminite from the least of the tribes of Israel? And is not my clan the humblest of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then have you spoken to me in this way?" Now, in Saul's defense, this is pretty typical for humans when they encounter God or one of his prophets. They tend to give at least one pushback when they have an encounter like this, but it's still pretty funny to see, right? Saul just seems to kind of glaze over the fact that the prophet answered the question he didn't ask. Remember, they came to get information about these lost donkeys, and Samuel basically says, "Hey, don't worry about those donkeys. They've been found. Also, God's going to give you everything that you could want in all of Israel." And Saul, in my opinion, is reasonably kind of distracted by that last bit. "Hey, Samuel, Mr. Prophet man, I think you might be wrong. I'm from the tribe of Benjamin, the youngest brother. We aren't the leaders of anything. Sorry, you're mistaken." But of course, Samuel is not mistaken, and he can prove it. God told him that Saul was coming just the day before, so Samuel shows them in verse 22. "Then Samuel took Saul and his young man and brought them into the hall and gave them a place at the head of those who had been invited, who were about 30 persons. And Samuel said to the cook, 'Bring the portion I gave you, of which I said to you, put it aside.' So the cook took up the leg and what was on it and set them before Saul. And Samuel said, 'See, what was kept is set before you. Eat, because it was kept for you until the hour appointed, that you might eat with the guests.' So Saul ate with Samuel that day. When they came down from the high place into the city, a bed was spread for Saul on the roof, and he lay down to sleep. Then at the break of dawn, Samuel called to Saul on the roof, 'Up, that I may send you on your way.' So Saul arose, and both he and Samuel went out into the street. As they were going down to the outskirts of the city, Samuel said to Saul, 'Tell the servant to pass on before us, and when he has passed on, stop here yourself for a while, that I may make known to you the word of God.'" So now Samuel has proven that Saul's arrival was not an accident or a coincidence. Samuel knew why Saul had come, and he had a place already set for him at the table, and there was a bed made for him to sleep in. The meeting is not convenient. It was divinely appointed. But what is the purpose of all of this? We get that Saul was sent to Samuel for a reason, but what is that reason? Well, God is still stacking the odds. God is going to give Saul every chance to be the best possible king a human could be, at least by human standards. Saul is already tall, rich, handsome, and physically capable. All of these traits are ideal for a political leader, for a military leader. Certainly, Saul is capable enough as it is, right? But God's still stacking the odds. He continues to do so in chapter 10. Then, this is chapter 10, verse 1. "Then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on his head and kissed him and said, 'Has not the Lord anointed you to be prince over his people Israel? And you shall reign over the people of the Lord, and you will save them from the hand of their surrounding enemies. And this shall be the sign to you that the Lord has anointed you to be prince over his heritage. When you depart from me today, you will meet two men by Rachel's tomb in the territory of Benjamin at Zelzah. And they will say to you, 'The donkeys that you went to seek are found. And now your father has ceased to care about the donkeys and is anxious about you, saying, "What shall I do about my son?" Then you shall go on from there farther and come to the yoke of Tabor. Three men going up to God at Bethel will meet you there, one carrying three young goats, another carrying three loaves of bread, and another carrying a skin of wine. And they will greet you and give you two loaves of bread, which you shall accept from their hand. After that, you shall come to Gibeath Elohim, where there is a garrison of the Philistines. And there, as soon as you come to the city, you will meet a group of prophets coming down from the high place with harp, tambourine, flute, and lyre before them, prophesying. Then the Spirit of the Lord will rush upon you, and you will prophesy with them and be turned into another man. Now when these signs meet you, do what your hand finds to do, for God is with you. Then go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I am coming down to you to offer burnt offerings and to sacrifice peace offerings. 7 days you shall wait until I come to you and show you what you shall do. When he turned his back to leave Samuel, God gave him another heart, and all these signs came to pass that day. Okay, now we're talking. If Saul had any reason to doubt that God was anointing him to be the leader of his people, they should certainly be gone by now. And I'm not trying to call anybody specifically out with this, but maybe you've been in a church or in an event or something when somebody, quote unquote, prophesied over you telling you things are going to be okay, or the Lord is with you, who can be against you? And this isn't to challenge that, but what Samuel is doing here is a little bit different than these vague feel-good statements. There isn't a lot left up to interpretation with what Samuel is saying. He's giving specific details. This dude's going to be carrying 3 young goats, and that dude's going to be carrying 3 loaves of bread, and he's going to give you 2 of them. This isn't cryptic prophecy. This is God speaking through Samuel about things that are real, tangible, measurable truths that actually happen. Here's what's going to happen. Here's how it's going to be. There's no explaining any of this away. God is once again proving his control and his knowledge. Ooh, kids, all-knowing. Anybody know what the word for all-knowing is? Oh. Omniscient, that's right. Very good. Our kids are learning great things. Tony, Tori, thank you. They're learning great things in the kids program, so appreciate it. Omniscient, all-knowing. There's no explaining any of this away. And it all happens just as Samuel said it would. And these things do more than just bolster the truth for Saul. Let's continue in verse 10. When they came to Gibeah, behold, a group of prophets met him. And the Spirit of God rushed upon him, and he prophesied among them. And when all who knew him previously saw how he prophesied with the prophets, the people said to one another, "What has come over the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" And a man of the place answered, "And who is their father?" Therefore, it became a proverb, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" When he had finished prophesying, he came to the high place. These events were so miraculous that they were the basis for a turn of phrase. Is Saul also among the prophets? That was a proverb among the people. People just said that because this thing was so wild that people took notice. At this point, the odds are fully stacked. God has taken Saul, a rich, tall, able-bodied, attractive young man, and has given him his word from his prophet that he's been selected to be the king over his people Israel. Then he proved Saul's calling using Samuel's prophetic word to guide Saul to prophesying himself. And the people noticed. Saul is now a rich, tall, able-bodied, attractive young man with the knowledge that God has chosen him to lead and the reputation to match. The people told Samuel they didn't need God to be their political leader. They didn't need God to be their military leader. They didn't need God to be their king. They just needed a good enough human to do that for them. And at this point, Saul is kind of looking like he actually might prove them right. Samuel was even so bold as to say, after these signs presented themselves, Saul could do whatever his hand finds first to do, for God was with him. In short, Samuel gives Saul the affirmation that God was with him and that there wasn't anything that was going to be impossible for him. Saul had the power of God on his side. And here's what he does with it, continuing in verse 14. Saul's uncle said to him and to his servant, "Where did you go?" And he said, "To seek the donkeys." And when we saw they were not to be found, we went to Samuel. And Saul's uncle said, "Please tell me what Samuel said to you." And Saul said to his uncle, "He told us plainly that the donkeys had been found." But about the matter of the kingdom of which Samuel had spoken, he did not tell him anything. Huh. That's odd. Maybe Saul has a good reason for that, though. Let's keep going. Now Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah, and he said to the people of Israel, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt, and I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. But today you have rejected your God, who saves you from all your calamities and your distresses. And you have said to him, 'Set a king over us.' Now therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your thousands." Then Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. He brought the tribe of Benjamin near by its clans, and the clan of the Matrites was taken by lot. And Saul, the son of Kish, was taken by lot. So Samuel's casting lots to show the people of Israel who God has selected to be their king. Casting lots is just a method of decision-making that was used in ancient times. It's kind of similar to drawing straws or rolling dice, in that basically kind of looks like it's a numbers game or a way of leaving things to chance. But that's not how the people of God saw it. The people of God saw it as a way to prove God's will. Proverbs 16:33, which I think we have, says it like this: "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." God is even in control over what humans believe to be random chance. If you've heard Christians say that they don't believe in coincidence, this is probably why. God is in control of how rocks and bones and dice fall onto the ground. Right? Now, of course, Samuel and Saul already knew who was going to be named king. So the casting of lots here was mostly for the benefit of everybody else. But it should have also been another point of confidence for Saul. "Hey, even the lot fell to you. Go ahead and take a bow, Saul." And then we come to verse 21 of chapter 10. "But when they sought him, he could not be found. So they inquired again of the Lord, 'Is there a man still to come?' And the Lord said, 'Behold, he has hidden himself among the baggage.'" After all that, after all of that, he hid. After having every single odd stacked in his favor, he hid. Even though he was a rich, tall, able-bodied, attractive young man with the knowledge that God has chosen him to lead and the reputation to match, he hid. Why? Why would he hide? And I can think of two answers. The literal reason I think Saul hid is because he didn't have faith in God. He, for whatever reason, he still believed that it was on his own strength that he would rise or fall. And if that was the case, I would hide too. And this kind of explains why he didn't tell his uncle what was going on. Kind of looks like he's in denial. "Yeah, I know what Samuel said, I know what God told me, but that can't be right. I can't do that. And honestly, I can't imagine trying to lead an entire country, God's entire people, with my own wisdom or efforts apart from God." But that's not what God told Saul. God told him he'd be with him. But Saul didn't believe that. Saul had no faith. But the second reason, I think, is maybe more compelling. The second reason I think Saul hid is a bit of a symbolic one. So watch throughout the rest of this book as we go through 1 Samuel. Be thinking about this. And try to notice all the times that Saul is just Adam. It's just Adam. We're talking like Scooby-Doo, rip off the mask. Hey, it was Adam the whole time. Remember what Adam did in the garden? When God came looking for him, he hid. Adam is Hebrew for man, Adam. And in the book of 1 Samuel, when God is juxtaposing the way of God against the way of man, Saul is often playing the part of man. He's just Adam. You mean Adam who introduced rebellion and sin into the world in spite of God's clear decree? Adam who was meant to be the representative of humanity but decided to oppose God instead of submit to him? Or Adam, who by sinning passed along original sin and punishment by being our federal head and leader? Yeah, it's just Adam. But this Adam did exactly what the first Adam did when he realized what it meant to be the representative for humanity. He hid. Point number two. There are two sides in the war between God and sin. And humanity, historically, takes the wrong side. We take the side of sin. We take the side of unbelief. We take the side of trusting in humanity's power over God's power. And just in case Saul's actions aren't enough to prove that, let's continue in verse 23 of chapter 10. Then they ran and took him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? There is none like him among all the people." And all the people shouted, "Long live the king!" Then Samuel told the people the rights and duties of the kingship, and he wrote them in a book and laid it up before the Lord. Then Samuel sent all the people away, each one to his home. Saul also went to his home at Gibeah, and with him went men of valor whose hearts God had touched. But some worthless fellows said, "How can this man save us?" And they despised him and brought him no present, but he held his peace. Now these worthless fellows are interesting, because I think they almost kind of had a point. But I think they're called worthless for one major reason. Even when God throws them a bone and does what they ask him to do, sorry, command him to do, they demand of him, they still hate it. There are some people that are so rebellious, God can't win for losing in their eyes. The same people that shouted, "Give us a king," look at the king God gave and said, "Not that one." Like, they can't, at this point, whatever God does, they hate it. They're opposed to God no matter what he does. They're taking the side of sin. And really, maybe more directly, they're taking the side of just not God, anything but God. And that brings us to point number three. You can usually tell which side is which by the apparent advantage. God tends to stack the odds against himself, but he will always end up victorious. And I could easily go to David at this point to show you some examples of this. And we have already talked about Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And we already talked about Gideon. But remember this. God's kingship was rejected by Israel in Saul's day. And God revealed himself and restored his rule over Israel through David, yes. But only sort of. Now, he really did do that. But the fullness of God's restoration of his rule was found in David's lineage. The fullness of this restoration was found in Jesus Christ. Let's look at Jesus' story compared to Saul's. For hundreds of years before Jesus was born, God said nothing through any prophets. And Jesus was born to a virgin in Bethlehem in Judea, to a couple of working class Israelites. He lived a quiet life for 30 years. Then he ministered to his people for 3 years while being badgered by the religious elite of his day and questioned at every turn. In John, Jesus stated that though he was the light come into the world, they hated the light and they loved the darkness. He called their works evil because they were evil, and they hated that. They hated him. And they hated him so much that they killed him. They killed him in shame and pain and nakedness and torture. But note this, what man meant for evil, God meant for good. Even the way that they killed him accomplished his purpose. Firstly, his blood was poured out as redemption for his people. God used man's wickedness to complete his sacrifice for his bride. But maybe more on topic, the crucifixion was also actually a coronation. Though meant for mockery and hatred and evil, the people who killed Jesus still kneeled before him. Though intended for pain, they still placed a crown on his head. Though meant for humiliation, they still lifted him on high. And though meant sarcastically, they still declared him King of the Jews. All the odds were stacked against Jesus. And even though humanity tried to kill him in shame, they still accidentally restored God to his rightful place as king. I'm pointing this out because there are many people who call themselves Christians who want to tell you that you should be living your quote-unquote best life now, or that following Jesus means that you get all the things you want. We often tell ourselves that we'll be more likely to trust God if he just did something miraculous in front of our eyes. But I'm telling you now that following God almost always looks like the odds are stacked against you. We say we want to see these miracles. Saul got to see so many of these things, and he still didn't trust in the Lord. How many miracles did Jesus do? And they killed him. God doesn't need to prove himself more. We need to have more faith and trust in him. And we need to have faith that God is worthy of following even when it looks like the odds are stacked against us. Or maybe even especially when the odds look like they're stacked against us. Historically, that's how God prefers to work. So when things look bleak or hard or like there's no way we can make it, let that be an encouragement to you. This is how James was able to say, "Consider it joy when you face trials. God does all of his best work when the odds look like they're stacked against him." God can literally say he tried to do the thing so many of us want to ask him, or rather demand him to do. God, just show your power. God, just prove yourself. God, just do a miracle and prove your goodness. He's done all of that. And it was ignored and even despised. Christian, we need to have faith in the word he's already given us. God will win. And so often being a Christian feels like being on the losing side. But that's good news. God usually stacks the odds against himself. Saul had all the odds in his favor, and he still hid. And eventually he loses. Spoiler. But it's true. But Jesus remains victorious forever. And even when all of the odds were stacked against him, he still won. Even when they tried to take him down, they accidentally crowned him king. He can't lose. Have faith in him and his ability to complete the work he has begun. And if you're here today struggling with thinking that everything falls to you and your ability, or if you're in a moment when the odds are stacked against you and you don't know what to do, or if you just want to pray that God would give you faith to trust him more, please pray with me or whoever else ends up over there, any of our leaders, because prayer and trust in God is how we're meant to respond. We can trust in him and his ability and not in our own. And in doing so, we can be a little less like Saul, a little more like Christ. Let's pray.